3, 2, 1. From the looks of Scheibel Auditorium Saturday afternoon, a lot of people in Fairbanks have questions about the Persian Gulf situation. An estimated crowd of more than 300 came to a town meeting to hear a panel of local experts talk about the economic and military implications of a war there, as well as the history of the region and energy-related issues. There were more questions than could be answered in the course of the two-hour forum, but the panel of six fielded plenty of questions anyway. It seems as though retired Army Colonel Wally Cox answered the most, asked to talk about the effects of chemical warfare and the likelihood of nuclear warfare, which Cox doesn't see as something the United States will use first. But Cox believes military action will not resolve things in a matter of weeks, as politicians speculate. Cox says he worries that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein will get the idea that he can hang on and win in the end. In that case, Cox says war is even more likely.
I think it's clear in the sketches that have been drawn of Hussein, and as you have read them in the papers, he is a person who is very direct and is going to have his way. I don't believe he's a madman, but he's demonstrated repeatedly barbaric behavior towards men and nations. And in my view, this is a situation that has to be dealt with, else, as the commercial says, you pay me now or you pay me later.
That barbaric behavior was emphasized by a Kurdish refugee on the panel who wanted to be known only as Nariman, since he fears retribution against his family by Iraq. Nariman left Iraq in 1986. He says Middle East governments don't represent the people. Military strongmen have been in control for years, and annexation by those leaders is routine. Nariman described how Hussein came to power and says the Iraqi leader doesn't understand why this action has caused so much concern.
He killed many thousands of his civilians, and the Kurds, nobody said anything. He killed millions of Iranian and Iraqis, nobody said anything. He went for it. And he made many, many other crimes. Nobody said anything. At last, he annexed Kuwait. He said, since I'm doing everything and nobody tell me anything, why you are doing this, so let me do the next step. His next step was annexing Syria or Kuwait. We say this since 1988, and nobody here. And he annexed Kuwait. But the point is, he's surprised right now. Why people doing this against him? Since he did everything, nobody said anything.
Nariman says, though, that even if Iraq withdraws from Kuwait, there are still many problems in the Mideast region left to be resolved. It's the instability of the Middle East that historian Peter Cornwall says will present problems far into the future. Cornwall says the current situation is the product of centuries of change and divisions of the Arab people. Even if the United Nations forces are successful in getting Hussein out of Kuwait, Cornwall says there will be more problems to solve in the Arab nations, and it's not a situation where we have allies that can be trusted if war breaks out.
The other Arab countries that are involved in this are very seriously thinking of their own interests rather than necessarily the position which the United Nations have taken. There is a possibility, at least on the part of some military observers, that in the event of hostilities, these countries, particularly Egypt and Syria, would not commit their forces to a significant extent, because in the case of Syria, at least, to do so would diminish the power of Assad within Syria itself and vis-a-vis Israel. So I would not regard them as the most dependable allies, nor expect to see them in the forefront of any action which takes place.
If the United States does use military action against Iraq later this week, it will be a big mistake, according to Vietnam veteran Ken Green. Green says this country can't afford a fight because veterans already are shortchanged by the federal government, and this country is still helping veterans from as far back as World War I deal with the psychological scars of battle.
America does not have the will to fight this war. The United States cannot afford this war because the government has not paid for the last ones, and the veteran will suffer for it.
From an economic point of view, economist Keith Criddle of UAF says military spending will help the country combat the recession, and Alaska's economy will enjoy more oil receipts, tourism, and defense spending. But in answer to a question from the audience about how the Persian Gulf crisis threatens the American way of life, Griddle says it doesn't.
This has nothing to do with our American way of life. Japanese and the Germans recognize fully that this has nothing to do with their way of life. They look at it and say it does not matter who controls those oil fields. They are going to sell oil. If we stood back and said, well, we don't care what's happening over there, it doesn't affect us, and Iraq went on, took Saudi Arabia in addition to Kuwait, and now they control 40% of the oil supply. This sounds really terrible, right? Monopoly, we're going to be in a bad position on this. Are we? Not really, because there are a lot of limitations to the power of monopoly. First, if they raise the price, guess what? It suddenly becomes profitable to take oil out of marginal fields, it becomes profitable to use enhanced recovery techniques, and the supply of oil has in effect increased. Second, if the price rises, demand does fall. And we've already observed a 2% reduction in worldwide demand on oil as a result of the current increase in price. Plus, an increase in the price of oil will spur the production and investment in alternative energy technologies.
Finally, devising an energy policy will help. Energy specialist June Weinstock told the audience that this country drifted into a dependence on foreign oil by default because we have no national energy policy and we wouldn't need to import Iraqi oil if we just waste less ourselves. Weinstock says the United States consumes twice as much as it produces, and about half of that energy is wasted. Weinstock says it makes far more sense to enhance current oil recovery techniques than to develop our wilderness areas.
We have a very finite, very limited reserve of petroleum. Our easily extractable proven reserves total 27 billion barrels. The total, including estimated undiscovered, and that includes what might be an Arctic refuge, are 90 billion barrels. Present rate of consumption, 6 billion barrels per year. If we continue business as usual, we have a 15-year supply of easily extractable crude remaining.
Saturday's panel discussion was sponsored by Amnesty International and the Fairbanks Education Association. While many questions did get answered, by the looks of how many hands were raised in the auditorium when questions were being taken, a lot of people also went home with questions still on their minds. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton.
For many charities in Alaska, selling pull tabs in bars and stores accounted for desperately needed revenues, dollars for everything from mental health programs to crisis centers. But state law, says the Attorney General, allows those charities only to sell games of chance directly to the public and not through what are known as third-party vendors. When a ban on third-party vendors went into effect January 1st, charities filed a motion asking for a temporary restraining order. They've now retreated from that position. Coalition Chair Jan McIlvery.
The motion filed last week requesting a restraining order has been withdrawn without prejudice. And the Coalition for Nonprofit Gaming has engaged the services of Edgar Paul Boyko.
Randall Burns is with the state's Division of Occupational Licensing.
I guess I'm not surprised. I think our feeling was that that the suit and the grounds on which the suit was being filed really didn't have much standing given the law itself.
While the coalition has dropped its motion for a temporary restraining order, Anchorage attorney Edgar Paul Boyko says he'll advise his clients to continue selling pull tabs in bars and stores despite the ban.
With the understanding that they could be prosecuted, but with the hope that the Department of Law will use some common sense and discretion. I mean, if they want to prosecute the disabled veterans or the Mental Health Association, more power to them. I mean, if they're really that politically stupid, go ahead.
Anytime someone suggests that anyone operate outside the parameters of the law, that we would have concerns for that.
Again, the state's Randall Burns.
The division itself is not involved in the criminal enforcement generally, if a permittee is selling pull tabs and it's not authorized, the action we have is to suspend their permit. It's not to file criminal actions. If there are criminal actions filed, that would probably have to be coming out of the local police if they wish to go after these four, what at this point would basically be not authorized charitable gaming, but illegal gambling.
With lawmakers returning to Juneau in less than 2 weeks, charitable gaming is sure to be a top item on the agenda. Charities say they're already feeling the crunch, especially in the bush. Boyko, who worked with Governor Hickel's campaign, says he'll push for change with the new administration. In Anchorage, I'm Brian Mann.
Three, two, one. Jim Ellison is editor of the newest paper, the Fairbanks Tribune. The John Lindauer publication has been welcomed with open arms, according to Ellison, who isn't worried about whether or not the market can support another weekly paper.
I believe it can. I don't know that to be a fact, and only time will tell. We will be carrying advertisements from businesses that ordinarily right now doesn't advertise, either because of political bias or opinions. We've been very fortunate in that regard, and this is hearsay I'm getting down for marketing people. So maybe there's a larger base than is being touched out there is really what we're talking about.
The Tribune comes out on Fridays, the same day as the 20-year-old All Alaska Weekly. The Weekly's new owner, Andy Williams, says having another paper will be good for all the papers in town because it will generate more interest. But he's not so sure the market can support another publication.
I guess we'll see. If it doesn't, I know that we aren't going to be the third paper. We're definitely the number two in the market now, and we intend to remain that way.
Williams has only been operating the Weekly for a few months, but he says response to the changes he's made has been terrific. Circulation is up about 20%. They printed 3,700 papers this week. He thinks people will stick with it instead of flocking to the competition.
I think it's going to be very hard for them to beat us in the quality of the product that they put out. I think that we're more in tune with the community here. I think we're closer to the community, and I think we do a better job of covering the news.
But the Tribune's Jim Ellison says people picking up the Tribune at newsstands will find something different.
I respect the other paper, but our paper is got a much larger base to it, and we're seeking to entertain and inform readers from all walks of life, not a narrow spectrum or political belief. John Lindauer has built a reputation of building and printing unbiased newspapers, and that's where we're at.
Well, that's great. You know, he assumes that we have a political perspective here.
Weekly owner Andy Williams, who says a political perspective from his paper is a thing of the past.
As far as I'm concerned, it's not the business of us to sell politics. We're selling newspapers here. And, I think that if a person has looked at the Weekly since we've taken it over, they'll find that the stories on the front page and everywhere but the editorial pages and in the commentaries that we run are straight news stories. As far as a political stance, the Tribune is run by a person that ran for governor, and is the general manager is a person who's on the city council. There has to be a political agenda there.
The editors of the Weekly papers see their competition as each other, not so much the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. The News Miner has competition concerns of its own. The paper publishes earlier in the day now, so it can hit the streets at the same time as the Anchorage Times, which is taking a higher profile here. News Miner advertising director Dave Slater says the Times competes more for readership than advertising dollars, but believes most readers use it to supplement the local news they get from the News Miner. Financially, Slater says the News Miner is just beginning to recover this year after four not-so-good years. Slater doesn't think the market will support another newspaper for long.
I think it will affect the News Miner, but I don't think, let me put it this way, I'm not worried that one of them will put us out of business. If I were either one of the weeklies, I would be more concerned to that degree. I think that they both, the improved All Alaska Weekly, which I really think it is, and the new Fairbanks Tribune will be more susceptible to business failure by competition amongst the two of them rather than competition with us.
Time will tell the impact of the new Fairbanks Tribune on the economics of the other papers, but Ellison, Williams, and Slater all agree that there is plenty of room here for other points of view. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton.
The orders to me and the reason I hired on here was that he wanted a paper built on the grounds of true journalism. And we're going to do our very best to try and provide that and provide balance, not just in the stories, but in the stories we choose to print. You'll find stories in there that goes totally against what we may personally believe. And that's true unbiased journalism. And that's what we're going to try and do.
I'd like to welcome you all here to the Fairbanks Inaugural Ball for the inauguration of our new governor and lieutenant governor. Glad you all can be here.
How are you, sir? Oh, my golly!
Skip Kimberlin and Ray Kimberlin, all-time best buddies.
Some came to congratulate Governor Hickel, others because it was good politics to be there, and others still just for the party. Dressed in tuxedos and fancy gowns, Fairbanksans took advantage of the chance to get dressed up and spend the night dancing and ringing in a new administration. After celebrating in Kodiak and Nome, Hickel, Lieutenant Governor Jack Coghill, and several cabinet members came here, where half of the voters cast their ballots for the Hickel-Coghill team. Inaugural coordinator Betsy Engel says about 1,100 tickets were sold for the local event. Among the guests chosen to make some remarks was the man who voters here liked in the primary election, Senator Rick Halford.
When somebody says, I'm from the government and I'm here to help, and nobody laughs, we know that Wally Hickel and Jack Coghill have really brought us into the new decade.
Halford also introduced Lieutenant Governor Jack Coghill, who clearly was among friends and family.
We believe in bringing forth what we think is going to be probably one of the finest decades of the Alaskan history, because we have a team. Because we have a team of fine commissioners, we have a team of between Wally and Jack, why we're going to make this all work, because we're going to have fun doing it, and because we've got the spirit, and because we know that Alaska has to turn around, and that we have to get back to the basics. And the basics is that the economics of the world and the economics of Alaska have to be driven by the private sector and not by the public sector. And that's where we're in.
But the main event was Governor Wally Hickel. Hickel quickly enthused the crowd with a remark about the Fish and Game Board's choices for a new commissioner, Lou Pamplin and Carl Rozier. Hickel has his own preferences for that job and joked about the matter when he saw the ice sculpture gracing the podium that bore his likeness.
It looks like a nice carving of me. And I just want to tell, if someone read the newspapers today, I want to tell the Fish and Game Board, I'm not that cold and I'm not that hard. But if they get in our way, Jack and I let them know what we think.
Hickel says he's saving comments for the State of the State address, but he did once again talk about what a unique and young state Alaska is.
We believe that collectively we care no more about this country than anyone else. Yes, we'll make our mistakes because we're just young, but there'll be mistakes of doing and not mistakes of intent. And we want those people out there to know, just to allow us to grow up. And we'll try to do the best we can with the knowledge we have from the mistakes they made. But don't punish us and say, no, you can't grow up. Always stay young.
The governor also got the first dance. He and his wife, Irma Lee, stepped onto the dance floor.
I'm going to ask her to dance because I like to hold her.
Yeah! Yeah!
Thank you.
For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Community Center was transformed from a hockey rink to a formal dining and dancing area. Local residents who wanted to party with the new governor put on some of their fanciest clothes to properly celebrate the affair. Governor Hickel and his wife Irma Lee and Jack and Francis Coghill initiated the dance floor after ceremonial remarks were made to the crowd of roughly 1,000 people. Governor Hickel is saving any announcements for his State of the State address, but he did recognize his warm welcome in Fairbanks.
I've been to several inaugurations, a couple in Washington, D.C., and none, I mean this from the bottom of my heart, is quite filled with hope, spirit, and warmth as this room tonight. God bless you.
Several cabinet members also attended the Fairbanks inaugural. Other balls are planned in Anchorage and Juneau. Fairbanks strongly supported the state's first independent party governor in the November election. Although party chairman Joe Vogler did not attend the event Saturday, many of the party goers were strong supporters who came to wish the new governor well. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton.
State agriculture officials were hit with a court ruling December 7th that forced them to keep the door open Friday when debt-ridden farmers reviewed their finances. But the Agricultural Revolving Loan Board still spent much of the day in closed executive session. Fairbanks Superior Court Judge Richard Savelle ruled last month that the board was in clear violation of Alaska's open meetings law because virtually all of its business was closed to the public. At Friday's lengthy public session, farmers from the Point McKenzie Dairy Project and the Delta Barley Project listened as Assistant Attorney General Brian Bjorkquist outlined what the ruling will mean.
The previous procedure has been that the delinquent borrower was notified of the upcoming board meeting and then was given an opportunity to come before the board and speak in executive session. At that point, after the discussion was completed, the borrower would be asked to leave and the board would deliberate in executive session. Now the borrower is also going to be given an opportunity to request that all the deliberations and also the discussion be held in public session. If the borrower elects to have the discussion in public session, all the presentation and deliberations will be in public session and open to everybody who wants to come and listen.
If farmers don't want their money situation revealed in public, the decision still gives them the option of a closed session, Bjornquist said. Division of Agriculture Director Frank Milkey said Friday that over the past decade, bad loans on state-offered farmland have reached a grand total of about $10 million. Agricultural Loan Fund Manager John Bashaw says open sessions to discuss them or not, the final word is up to the state attorney general.
No, the board can just do so much. So if a borrower wants a settlement in lieu of litigation, let's say, it has got to be in the office of the AG. Those are the only people that have the authority to change the principal due, the interest rate, the time in excess of the statutory limits.
Loan fund manager John Bashaw. The lawyers were still lining up late in the day when we spoke with Delta Barley farmers Kate and Jerry Brenner. They and other farmers say the whole state system of agriculture is flawed.
Personally, I think that if I could get it back in the barley business, I'd want to stay as far away from any kind of political ties as I can. And I think we'll try it on our own this time without having to worry about who's governor or who's loan manager or who's director of division of ag or what.
Delta area farmer Jerry Brenner, he might be considered one of the semi-lucky ones. Of 19 dairy farms on Point McKenzie 10 years ago, there are now only three in operation. Lawyer Mike Stepovich was one of the attorneys present Friday. He agrees that the system of loaning money for farms needs an overhaul, and he was hopeful that the new administration will be more sympathetic to farmers. In Palmer, I'm Robert Hawk.
FASE had originally planned to reach Cold Bay by December,
but that was before he actually experienced the vastness of the state and the unpredictable weather in the fall. He said he rode his rubber boat down the Koyukuk River in October, past Hughes and Huslia, and then ran into the Yukon River in a sudden change in conditions.
And really big waves, and the day I came to Nulato, I was really wet from the water, from waves, you see. I thought, but this river cannot freeze at once. At least I will have some warnings, you see. So I decided to spend 2 days in Nulato. And the next morning, when I was in Nulato, I was going above the into the graveyard, above the town. And the ice started to run on the Yukon. It was just incredible.
Then he said the ice and the 15 below zero temperatures made him alter his plans. He said he went on foot again from Kaltag over 100 miles down to Grayling, where he has remained for the past 2 months. But before reaching that destination, he encountered a pack of wolves.
They had tried to get a moose, and it was blood all over on the ice of a slough. And I was walking towards them, and they came very close to me. It was interesting.
They didn't bother you, though, huh?
It was okay. They were very close, and the big male was too close, I thought, so I started shooting, not for killing him, but just to make him afraid. So he went away, but there were still the kids were staying around, but it was okay.
And you just went on, huh?
Yeah. But I had to, the problem is, I had to really go over the moose blood and flesh. So this is why maybe they didn't want to move.
Fassay said he's staying with an Indian family in Grayling and helping people out wherever he can. If all goes well, he plans to head out again in late February and hopefully reach Cold Bay sometime in May. He said the biggest thing he's learned from the trip so far is how spread out the villages in Alaska really are.
It was about 1,200 or maybe more miles, and I've visited only, I think, 7 villages. So that's really incredible. In France, every 2 miles, there is a village.
In Barrow, I'm Earl Finkler.
Three, two, one. Burrow dumpsters piled high with trash have greeted area residents lately. While the situation is improving, the trash-related problems never seem to end. One solution the Burrow administration sees is to hire a new manager to handle all the Burrow trash issues, from the new garbage collection locations to helping the search for a new landfill. Problems with trash in the Burrow have accelerated lately. The man who hauls trash from Burrow dumpsters had problems with his equipment, so trash kept piling over the holidays. The borough's new health and safety director, Bob Spencer, says things look a little better now.
We helped them clean up some of the sites last week with some heavy equipment and dump trucks. And apparently over the weekend he did a pretty good job cleaning up the Chena Hot Springs Road sites.
With the messes that accumulate around the dumpsters, some of the people who allow them on their property are changing their minds. Hazardous materials, possibly contaminating soils, have already raised concerns from some property owners. Spencer says without change, requests to have the dumpsters removed will continue to come in.
They've not asked us to leave yet, but they've said that if things don't improve, we're going to be asked.
Part of the solution to these problems will come when dumpster sites in rural areas are improved and garbage collection stations are built in the borough's most urban areas. Last fall, voters approved spending $2 million to do that. Spencer says the plan is to open the North Pole Transfer Station after July 1st and build 3 other new stations. They still need to find land on the west side of Fairbanks, though, but Spencer believes the $2 million will cover the costs.
We're confident right now that we can still do that. We're on the verge of being absolutely sure, because there are ways to cut back on the projects and still have a viable system put in place for that. Some of the fancy niceties might go away, but those haven't been determined yet.
Borough officials see the other part of the solution is hiring someone to deal with all these problems. The Health and Safety Department has been short-handed for the last several months. Solutions to the trash problems may require more work than current staff can handle. Chairman of the Borough Assembly's Solid Waste Committee, Hank Bartos, is all for the addition.
Because there has to be a focal point within the administration to manage solid waste. And, you know, we started out with Dick Jackson working the problem along with Kelly McMullen. But their duties within the administration did not entail solid waste per se. And that's one of the biggest things that this borough is responsible for, is the health and safety of the citizens. And just letting garbage happen wasn't working.
Hiring a manager may have some detractors on the borough assembly. Those who opposed putting the $2 million bond issue on the ballot in the first place are still questioning the plans to build transfer stations, already raising concerns that they'll be too costly or not what the voters expect. But Bartos is confident that the majority of the assembly agrees with him and sees the importance of continued progress toward solving the garbage problems.
There was one or two of them that were concerned about the transfer station bond issue, that the money was being spent, and there was all kind of rumors, but it was all based on rumors. And I was, you know, quite frankly surprised that members of the assembly would respond to rumors rather than coming to the committee and you know, getting the real scoop and asking what it is. And that's why I'm preparing this annual report to the presiding officer of what is happening.
And Health and Safety Director Bob Spencer hopes the assembly will see the need to hire someone to deal with the borough's trash problems.
I think there's only a couple real detractors on the assembly, and I won't mention names, but you know, I think everyone is beginning to realize the solid waste issues are a big problem, and if you don't have someone on staff to deal with them, they're not going to be dealt with.
The assembly will be asked to consider approving a solid waste manager later this month. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Privatizing the landfill was tried unsuccessfully a year or two ago, but the assembly still thinks it can be done. The borough's solid waste committee has been working on a proposal that those who want the job can bid on. Committee Chairman Hank Bartos says the process has been a little slower than expected.
It did not go as fast as we had hoped for it to go because there was a great deal of coordination that had to be taken place, and the bid process and the evaluation process and everything, and that was part of this committee that held that up because several of the committee members weren't satisfied with the evaluation criteria, and that delayed it for 4 to 6 weeks, and it finally did get on the street, and it didn't go quite as fast as we wanted to, but the process is evolving and it's moving.
Bartow says there's a lot of interest in the bid. The deadline for proposals is later this month. In the meantime, collecting the borough's garbage is creating bigger problems. The man who hauls the trash from borough dumpsters to the landfill had problems earlier this month with his equipment, so trash continued to mount at the dumpster sites. The borough's health and safety director, Bob Spencer, says the borough has been helping the hauler get those dumpsters cleaned up, but doesn't want that job permanently.
The borough would probably be reluctant to come in, possibly on a short-term basis. We have very limited equipment to begin with, and there are other contractors in the area that can provide at least some of the help. And between their help and the equipment we have, we could probably take over quite a few little sites if we had to.
Spencer says trash at the dumpster sites still isn't down to an acceptable level. The borough is also working on finding a new landfill, building garbage collection stations, and improving the dumpster sites in rural areas. They hope to hire a solid waste manager to make sure all that work gets done. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
Pickles Press Secretary Vivian Hamilton says the governor will likely meet with both Lou Pamplin, current head of the Division of Wildlife Conservation, and Carl Roser with the National Marine Fisheries Service before making any decision on the appointment.
I think the governor realizes that he can't just arbitrarily rule those out until he finds out a little bit about them, and the best way to do that is to sit down with them and talk to them. So he'll take that opportunity this week or next week.
Hamilton says if the two nominations prove not to the governor's liking, he may ask for the boards to submit further names. If they continue to make recommendations that are not to the liking of the governor, he can ask that board member step down. But Hamilton says there is no talk of that at this time.
Right now, the answer is no. I've talked to him a couple of times about what he sees as the future of this board, and so far he's decided that he's going to leave it like it is and see what comes from them and what recommendations they make.
Hamilton says for now at least, Governor Hickel seems to be comfortable with the makeup of the board. Hickel wanted either Tucker Thompson, an attorney and commercial fisherman from Nikiski, or Ron Somerville, a former director of the State Division of Wildlife Conservation. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Carrie Beebe.
Senator Ted Stevens says he's pessimistic that there's anything short of the use of military force that will get Hussein out of Kuwait. And while there will be lively debate about it in Congress, the ultimate outcome will be a resolution similar to what has already passed the United Nations, endorsing the use of force, but stopping short of declaring war. Stevens is not one of those in Congress who say a declaration must precede making war. He believes that the president legally has this authority, and it has been used in the past in situations where the U.S. has enforced actions of the United Nations.
I believe the Constitution is plain. The president cannot declare war against another country, but the president can use his, our forces in a way which would cause war. And that was demonstrated in World War II, too.
So Stevens backs the Bush administration's contention that military action to remove Saddam Hussein could easily stop short of war, and a declaration would follow the use of force. Stevens says even action on the resolution will wait till after the deadline of the 15th. The senator says war, when or if it came, could be quick. He agrees with Hawaii Senator Daniel Inouye that 5 days could do it, but those 5 days would not start right away. For one thing, while the Air Force and Navy are ready to go, the ground forces are not. So Stevens does not expect to move against Iraqi forces in Kuwait right at the deadline.
It is not an automatic trigger. A war doesn't start at 12:01 a.m. on the 16th. That's fairly clear.
But the senator says some kind of action at some time after the deadline is looking more and more likely. If Saddam Hussein is to be out by the 15th, he'd better get started, and so far he hasn't. In Stevens' view, he still has some time, but not much.
Well, he got in there in 3 days. He could get out and still got time to get out. But it's getting, as I said, it's getting pretty close to a deadline for him. He's got to initiate something here soon if he's going to get out.
Stevens says the most awesome armada in the history of the world is assembled in Saudi Arabia.
I think everybody has to realize that we're in a place of great risk, and it is caused by a desire for peace. I continue to pray we will have peace.
The senator says he believes it is still possible to come out of this crisis with the world more secure. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel. It's luck.
My name is Ram Chandra Biswas.
Ram Chandra Biswas left his home in Calcutta almost 9 years ago to devote his life to travel and saving the world. He's a devout Hindu, speaks 8 languages, and doesn't carry much money, just lives by his wits and the charity of strangers. During Biswas's visit in 77 countries, he's pedaled his bike 130,000 miles.
My ambition to understand the people of different countries, share feelings, views with each other. I believe international fraternity and brotherhood.
Biswas spreads his message of fraternity and brotherhood where he can. He carries an enormous book of pictures and correspondence he's gathered from government leaders in Africa, as well as South and North America. People, Biswas said, all gave him an audience. His biggest audiences come with a magic show he does, but mostly, says Biswas, it's the families who offer him food and shelter that find his message the most meaningful.
In 9 years, I never meet any bad people. Nobody beat me. Nobody robbed. I never have accident. I never going to hospital. 77 country I cross. No, don't have any problems, immigration, visa. Everybody welcomes to me.
A self-described missionary for world peace, the 33-year-old Biswas figures to be on the road for another 6 years, visiting countries in Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. Their current crisis there is unsettling to Biswas. He says people all over the United States, where he's been traveling since August, are worried about war.
I try to people to tell, please think before war, because this war is very worst war. and how many people going to die after, you can think. When it's starting, you can't stop this thing. But before, you can try.
Besides the threat of war, Biswas says the world is in dire danger from injustice, indifference, and the loss of family unity. His plans for a family of his own, however, will have to wait while his travels continue. Ask Biswas where he's been, and he'll give you the countries in chronological order.
Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania, Malawi, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Zambia.
Biswas is in Juneau now, his bicycle somewhat out of place in the snows of January, but he hopes to wrangle a ride to Anchorage, and from there it's on to Europe. When he arrives home in Calcutta in 1996, Biswas says he'll have plenty of material for a book. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
Mexico, USA, Canada, no, Alaska.
Three, two, one. Stevens talked to reporters here Tuesday afternoon, to Alaska's senior senator. It's all a matter of what Saddam Hussein believes. If the Iraqi leader believes that President Bush has the authority to force him out of Kuwait by January 15th, Stevens believes he'll get out. Stevens says that's the intent of the United Nations resolution setting the deadline for Hussein's withdrawal. And the president is now only asking Congress to back that up with a resolution of its own.
Right now, the thing we must do is show our resolve as a nation to support the UN in its position that Saddam Hussein must withdraw. We remain convinced that if he really believes that we will use force, he will withdraw. If he doesn't believe we'll use force, he's going to be very surprised, because we will use force.
And Stevens says it won't be a fair fight. The U.S. has newer equipment and weapons now with 15 times the firepower when he fought in World War II. And modern technology also means we can watch Hussein's every move. Although he used the word war during the course of his conversation, Stevens says the president hasn't asked for a declaration of war, and he doesn't think it will come to that. Stevens says debate over a declaration of war is an attempt to cast a cloud on the U.S. deployment of troops in the first place. That deployment, he says, is supported by most of the mail that he gets and by the military personnel he visited in the Gulf. In fact, Stevens considers this a turning point in history if it works. He says if aggressors like Hussein can be turned back and forced to leave to prevent war, it's going to be a different world. But it's up to Hussein.
I'm still one of those who believes that we will not have war if Saddam Hussein believes that we will take military action. It will be awesome military action if we take it. If he does not leave Kuwait. We're all awaiting the outcome of the visit with Secretary Baker and the Iraqi foreign minister. But somehow or other, we've got to find a way to have this man understand that the terrible consequences of thwarting the world will of the world. So I continue to pray that he will get the message. And if he doesn't, it's going to be awesome and quick and devastating result.
Stevens says he does believe Congress will vote to give the president the authority to use our forces, so there'll be no question in Saddam Hussein's mind. For KUAC News, I'm Ian Thornton.
I still believe he's going to get the message.
Okay.
I'm not certain he will. I'm more pessimistic than I was before I went to the Middle East because some of the things were told us over there. But I still believe it will happen. That a nation of 17 million people, having an area one-third the size of Alaska, his whole country is the size of South Central Alaska, just cannot survive against the world. Everybody's telling him that. But the problem is the reports come back out of Iraq that he does not believe we will use our power against him if he does not leave. Now that, he's got to be convinced. That's why we're meeting this week. We're going to vote the president the authority to use our forces so that there's be no question about it in anyone's mind in the world. Now that's why we're going back. We believe we'll get it.
Three, two, one. Statistics show drugs or alcohol help kill one of five Alaskans. Among Alaska Natives, the suicide rate is four times the national average. A lot is going on to try to help solve those problems, But Rural Health Education Center Director Dan Johnson says no one knows exactly what programs are going on where. This new grant will help the center bring that picture into focus.
We've learned that there's an awful lot of activity going on in the area of training rural mental health and substance abuse counselors. And there's an awful lot of community-based activity which is going on. But the extent of other people being aware of what is going on is pretty limited.
Johnson says the grant of more than $300,000 will create a Rural Alaska Health Education and Training Subcenter. Its first job will be to catalog information on what's being done and then distribute that information across the state.
There's millions of dollars being spent annually on addressing these health problems. On the other hand, there's not very much money being spent on understanding what's going on, knowing what's going on. In other words, it's very difficult for healthcare providers in these fields to know what other people are doing in other parts of the state and what sort of successes in training, for instance, alternative care providers, what sort of success they're having in training those sorts of people, and what sort of success they might be having in alternative or innovative community-based educational and training programs.
Johnson says the center won't provide direct services, but will train people to provide them, and the training won't replace anything going on now, but will support it instead. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. The Health Education Training Center got a grant of more than $300,000 to add a training center. Rather than create training programs, Director Dan Johnson says the plan is to find out what programs are going on in the state and help steer professionals and those who want healthcare careers to those training programs.
Currently, our program has the broad mission of supporting the healthcare system in rural Alaska. And primarily, we've been focusing on the traditional healthcare providing roles such as nursing and physicians, pharmacists, and so forth. We have also, in the past, supported some training efforts in the area of mental health and substance abuse, but very little, and only as a small part of what we're doing. Now, this new program is intended to expand our activities into this area because our board of directors felt that feels that this is the number one health problem in the state.
Alaska Natives have a high rate of suicide, and Johnson says many are alcohol-related. Natives also have one of the highest rates of fetal alcohol syndrome in the nation. Healthcare providers can get training to address those types of problems and emphasize prevention. He says right now what's available isn't coordinated well enough to determine exactly what's working and what isn't.
I personally don't have a knowledge of what is successful and what is not. People I consulted who work in the field actually have told me that one of the greatest needs that they see is for someone simply to develop a forum by which this information can be shared and these programs can be identified and cataloged as a real basic first step in trying to meet the training needs in this area.
The state has a network of community mental health programs, and the center will tap that network to catalog information about what's available. Johnson says a steering committee will meet to find out how many people are training healthcare providers, see if additional people are needed, and try to point young people toward careers in that line of work. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton.
Sports.
Governor Walter Hickel said he wanted an education board that is going to take a different look at state education. While there are no specifics, his philosophy has been conservative. And according to Assistant Press Secretary Ed Witcher, that's just what the governor was looking for in the Board of Education.
I think it is very safe to say that this board more clearly reflects the philosophy of Governor Hickel generally than did the previous board.
Witcher says he's not clear on just what the governor's education philosophy is,
But he says the new members have many years of service on local school boards that they will bring with them.
If you look at the resumes of the people chosen, then a couple of things pretty clearly stand out. One is that yes, their philosophies are closer to the governor's than the philosophies of those who were here before serving on the board. The second thing is that there's a great deal of, much more even than I expected, years of experience dealing in education, specifically. Andy Warwick in Fairbanks, a four-year member of the school board there. June Nelson, in 14 years of the Northwest Arctic Borough School District. And Patricia Norheim, 21 years of the Petersburg Board of Education.
Also on the list are Joe Montgomery, a school superintendent and principal, Robert Walp, vice chairman of GCI, Jack Phelps, president of Alaska Private and Home Educator Association, also pastor of Covenant Bible Church in Talkeetna, and Catherine Cuddy, former legislative aide. Witcher says the governor has not had a chance to talk with the new board yet and will not do so for quite a while, as at least one member is out of state. Witcher says Hickel has therefore not given any direction as to who he would like to see nominated as the Commissioner of Education. In fact, Witcher says the governor is completely open to suggestions and is even advertising the position. Where exactly, he couldn't say. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Carrie Beebe.
In Vladivostok, there is a young and unofficial free press. I can buy newspapers with names like Svobodny Slovo, or Free Word, or the independent Moscow News. They carry provocative headlines like No More Circuses, Bread, and the USSR Will Not Wait for Godot. While walking along Leninskaya, the main street in Vladivostok, Marina Herzenko, a high school student who offered to serve as an interpreter, and I encountered two young men wearing peace buttons. One is selling newspapers at 50 kopecks. The other is speaking into a bullhorn. Marina offers to translate some of what he is saying.
And about citizens of Vladivostok who were in prisons during the Stalin's years.
Excuse me? So what are the papers that you are distributing?
Какие газеты вы продаете?
Я продаю бюллетени Сахаров с нами, выпущенные в Владивостокской независимой редакции газеты «Трибуна».
This paper is called Academic Sakharov With Us. It is published by an independent committee associated with the Tribune in Vladivostok. Among other things, this paper publishes information in Sakharov's memory about political prisoners still being held for their beliefs in Gorbachev's Soviet Union. The paper claims that independent human rights organizations have named 140 such political prisoners. His paper says more are held in insane asylums. He criticizes Gorbachev for accepting the Nobel Peace Prize while such things are still happening in the Soviet Union.
Are you frightened to be out here selling these papers and talking about this? Does this worry you?
Вы не боитесь продавать газеты и говорить об этом вот на улице свободно?
Нет, я не боюсь. Я этого не боюсь.
No, he isn't frightened.
Why?
Почему?
Хотя нас уже несколько раз тут преследовали. Несмотря на всевозможные разрешения.
He is taken by military without any laws and even against the law of our country now. But he thinks he must do his work best.
При этом милиция наша Владивостокская обещала.
It happened in the end of November this year, and our military promised them that they would be punished.
I asked him if he had hopes that things would change for the better in the new year.
У меня такой надежды вообще нет, что что-нибудь изменится, потому что я не верю в политику Горбачева, я не верю в политику партии и нынешнего правительства. То, что у нас сейчас происходит, это просто политическая игра. Они
пытаются. And he thinks it's only game, political game. And Gorbachev only wants to take help from other countries. And that's why he thinks democracy communities in the USA, for example, can't believe Gorbachev and his politics. He thanks you for your attention and asks you to come more often to show all the world about things that happen here.
There are loudspeakers all along the Leninskaya. At that point, two speakers just over us came on very loudly, interrupting our conversation. When we broke off conversation, the radio went off. When we tried to talk, it came back on. I had wanted to ask him more, like specifically what happened when he was brought in by the military. He tried to tell me that he trusted no politicians who were or had been communists. They were all self-serving, both Gorbachev and Russian Federation President Boris Yeltsin. I gave him my hotel address, and he agreed that we could continue our conversation in a more private setting. He told me that if he could not make it, he would send over some English translations from his paper. I did not see him again. The translations did not reach me at the hotel. I'm Rich McClear.
William Jacobs is a UAA political science professor, and he's been getting a lot of questions about the Middle East lately. Everyone from the kids in his daughter's junior high class to medical doctors are wondering if there'll be a war, and why is the United States so involved in the Middle East?
And it's because people, I think, want to have what you might call, they want to have an ideal for which to fight, and frankly, that sort of thing isn't available here. although one could argue that the restoration of sovereignty to Kuwait is a worthy object. Defending one's material interests, even when they're important, is difficult to sell.
Jacob senses that people are naturally scared about a major military conflict, but there's more than a possibility of war that's bothering Americans.
The combination of the approaching deadline with a bad economy, a real awareness of certain weakness in our national institutions, all of those things taken together probably have people more worried than they would be ordinarily.
For the past few weeks, a handful of residents have protested near the town square. A few of the protesters have a son now stationed in Saudi Arabia. Reverend Polly Dozier is helping organize a candlelight vigil. She emphasizes it's not a demonstration of anything, but rather an exhibition of peace.
We're not anti-military. We're not anti any of the efforts that our government is making on this. We just, you know, feel, I think, in general, everybody that's there feels very, very strongly that it's going to be quite a detriment to us all if we have to go to war.
Dozier says she's hoping leaders will recognize there are other ways besides war to bring about solutions. In Anchorage, I'm Sarah Murabito.
Charities say they've dropped their request for a temporary restraining order that would have blocked the state's ban on pull tab sales in bars and stores. Joanne Labello reports.
The Coalition for Nonprofit Gaming has decided not to go to court over the state's ban on pull tab sales in bars and stores. Coalition Chairwoman Jan McGilvery.
The motion filed last week requesting a restraining order has been withdrawn without prejudice, and the Coalition for Nonprofit Gaming has engaged the services of Edgar Paul Boyko.
Charities say they're already hurting from the state's ban, but Edgar Boyko says he's advising his clients to continue their sales through third-party vendors. According to Boyko, charities could then be open to criminal prosecution.
I mean, if they want to prosecute the disabled veterans or the Mental Health Association, more power to them. I mean, if they're really that politically stupid, go ahead.
In Anchorage, I'm Joanne Labello.
It looks as though the Valdez Vanguard will be purchased by Alaska Newspapers, owned by Chugach Native Corporation head Edgar Blatchford. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner announced reacquisition of the Vanguard last week after a deal between the Miner and former Vanguard publisher Len Wolf went sour. Blatchford owns several newspapers around the state. Mark Moran reports.
The asking price for the paper is $450,000. That'll buy both the Vanguard and the Cordova Times, which is run by the Vanguard. The Vanguard was reacquired last week by the Fairbanks Daily News Miner after former Vanguard publisher Lynn Wolfe and the News Miner couldn't reach a new contract agreement, which involved some litigation, although neither Wolfe nor the News Miner would comment on it. But that reacquisition is only a temporary setup until the paper is sold. Vanguard editor and general manager Steve Dunson says the change in management has substantially changed daily operations of the paper, even if only temporarily.
We are being printed at present in Fairbanks. Our composing is being done in Fairbanks. All we're doing here right now is news, advertising, sales, and taking classifieds. Before, the entire operation of the newspaper was done locally. The paper was printed locally, composed, shot, everything. We have equipment in the building to completely do everything from start to finish.
The Vanguard will be printed in Fairbanks by the News Miner until the Vanguard is sold. And Dunson says the content and news coverage of the Vanguard will remain the same. Blatchford owns the Seward Phoenix Log and the Tundra Drums. The Drums is a native paper, but Dunson says if Blatchford does buy the Vanguard, its reporting won't change.
See, you have to tailor a newspaper to the community it serves. And there may be some additional coverage of native issues, but I don't see any real drastic changes in that area.
No one answered the phone at Alaska Newspapers, and Blatchford could not be reached for comment. In Valdez, this is Mark Moran.
3, 2, 1. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein is a military strategist who takes action, sees what's going on, and then takes a new position. That, according to a Kurdish refugee on the panel, who asked to be identified only as Nariman, since he still fears for those he left behind in Iraq 4 years ago. Nariman says for years the military leader has done what he wanted and gotten away with it.
What he did for against us, he went to the war 1974, and he lost 65,000 soldiers over there. We lost about 20,000 of our people over there, and after that his decision was he's not going to win, so he decided to go personally to Shah of Iran and to make a pact with Iran to make a special treaty to close the border against us, and we got surrender. It's the same way that he did against Iran. He went to the war at the beginning. The very ugly things that he did against the Iranian people on the border, the kind of rape and any other things that he made, he's making it right now in Kuwait. He made the same thing. He's just like a kid. He's smashing everything around him, and his parents, they didn't tell him anything.
Nariman says after years of doing what he wanted, Hussein is now surprised that someone is saying no. But the Kurd warns that even if Hussein does withdraw his troops from Kuwait, there are many more problems which still need to be resolved in the region, and he doesn't see military action against Hussein as the only solution. The panel also touched on economic, energy, and military issues involved in the potential military conflict. But when one man asked how the American way of life is threatened by the crisis in the Middle East, economics professor Keith Criddle says it isn't.
If we stood back and said, well, we don't care what's happening over there, it doesn't affect us, and Iraq went on, took Saudi Arabia in addition to Kuwait, and now they control 40% of the oil supply. This sounds really terrible, right? Monopoly, we're going to be in a bad position on this. Are we? Not really, because there are a lot of limitations to the power of monopoly. First, if they raise the price, guess what? It suddenly becomes profitable to take oil out of marginal fields. It becomes profitable to use enhanced recovery techniques, and the supply of oil has in effect increased. Second, if the price rises, demand does fall. And we've already observed a 2% reduction in worldwide demand on oil as a result of the current increase in price. Plus, an increase in the price of oil will spur the production and investment in alternative energy technologies.
There were many questions the audience in the crowded auditorium was waiting to pose during the two-hour forum. There was only time to answer a fraction of them. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
Unfortunately, there is absolutely nothing encouraging. I just came from a meeting at the White House that lasted about an hour and a half, and there was the leadership, both the House and the Senate, plus the ranking and chairman of the Armed Services Committee, the Intelligence Committee, and the Foreign Relations Committee. So I participated as vice chairman of the Intelligence Committee. Unfortunately, both the briefing by Secretary of State Baker, who has just come back, as you know, from meeting with 13 of our allied nations, as well as his meeting with Aziz, did not indicate any current reason to believe that there was something else that might come up. However, the president was very hopeful that something would occur, either an indication in the last minute that Saddam Hussein had gotten the message and was at least willing to initiate a discussion of withdrawal. But clearly it was not the expectations that we had all hoped for.
Now, we have heard that there was a delegation from Yemen bringing a proposal that the United States had already rejected over to Baghdad, and latest word that Francois Mitterrand may be going to Baghdad as well for some 11th-hour diplomacy. Is there any reason to think that they might succeed where Jim Baker failed?
No, there is not. The reason for that is that the United Nations Secretariat, Pérez de Cuellar, had been rudely rebuffed by Saddam Hussein. This was the second time that that happened, but this time he kept him cooling his heels for some time. We had an extended briefing by Secretary Cheney as well on the state of readiness, and you know, I can assure you that in the opinion of those who were there, we are ready, but nevertheless it was a very somber meeting, and all aspects of our preparedness as well as the current efforts to pursue any negotiation that would indicate that Saddam Hussein would meet this deadline were explored.
The deadline approaches. What's your feeling for how quickly, once that deadline is passed, how quickly we might find ourselves in a combat situation?
I have no knowledge of just what, nor do I think it's appropriate that you know, that kind of information be discussed. The difficulty we're having is all the signals are very, very negative. You know, while it's easy to say that the ball's in Saddam Hussein's court, clearly there's no other way to put it.